Welcome to PostView.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the Rural Communities Initiative Economic Development Webinar. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question and answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Wednesday, April 29th, 2009. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mrs. Jackie Smith. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Hi, and welcome to the Rural Communities Economic Development Webinar. Before we start, I just want to go over a couple quick logistical points to get them out of the way, and then we'll start the presentations. The first is that there will be a live question and answer session at the end of the presentation. The operator will explain how to ask a question through the phone when the presentation is complete. Also, we will be using live meeting to ask questions. If you could think of a question that you'd like to ask during the middle of the presentation, you can send the question in using live meeting. This way, you do not have to wait till the end of the presentation, and you'll also be able to ask more than one question. If you look at the screen in front of you, there are three quick steps. The first is to click on the top where it says Q&A and type your question in, then hit Ask. After that, two things will happen. It'll get sent to me, and I will send you a response to let you know we've gotten your question. When we've received your question and you've gotten this response back, you're free to ask another question, so don't hold back. Also, if you're looking at the screen and it looks a little small for you, you can hit the F5 button on your keyboard, and that will make it full screen. But if you're using a Mac, don't hit F5 because you'll be disconnected. But again, if you're in the F5 mode, you have to hit the Escape button or F5 a second time to come back to the normal screen to ask a question. And now I'd like to turn it over to James Butler. Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie. Hello, everyone, and welcome again to this Rural Communities Initiative webinar on strategies for economic development through job creation in rural areas to improve service delivery to rural TANF programs. As I've mentioned on several calls before, during the Rural Communities Academy back in September, the challenge of improving economic development was identified by many rural communities, initiative sites, as one of the most critical issues facing rural organizations serving TANF participants. As part of their technical assistance plan, sites expressed interest in learning more about effective strategies to create jobs, improve local economies, and increase opportunities for rural residents. These rural TANF agencies specifically expressed the need to learn more about current efforts to create employment opportunities for TANF participants in underserved rural areas, innovative strategies and tools for creating jobs, and funneling rural TANF participants into jobs, strategies on how to maximize return on investment for expanding job opportunities in rural areas, and guidance on funding and implementing these projects. So based on this interest by our rural sites, we've designed a series of technical assistance events that focus on the issues of economic development. The first of which is today's webinar on strategies for economic development through job creation. Today, we have some very knowledgeable speakers from different programs discussing their experiences with job creation strategies with an emphasis on green jobs and skills to improve options for TANF participants, dislocated workers, and other individuals looking to build and develop skills in the growing green jobs economic arena. After the presentations from our speakers today, we will open the lines up for the participants to ask questions. Our first speaker for today will be Mr. Nick Goulet from the Watershed Research and Training Center. Nick is the Deputy Director of the Watershed Research and Training Center in Hay Fork, California. The Watershed Research and Training Center is a community-based nonprofit organization that started in 1993 to promote healthy communities and sustainable forest through research, education, training, and economic development. The center's goal is to develop and encourage sustainable forest-based activities and a vibrant economic system for Hayfork and all of Trinity County, California. WRTC works to achieve these goals by providing training to displaced workers and assessing ecosystems, restoration projects, and business skills, providing microloans to entrepreneurs who market non-timber forest products, and creating a Hayfork-based GIS center and social economic monitoring program. NICS work centers around community-based and regional research into forest work, contracting, and wood utilization, coordinating local collaboration with U.S. Forest Service, associated with forest restoration and fuel reduction activities, developing assistance programs for local contractors, and advocacy for national forest, energy, and development policies that benefit rural communities. Ladies and gentlemen, I introduce to you Nick.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, James.
You're quite welcome.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks for having me. It's a good introduction to who we are and what we do. As James said, the Watershed Center started in 1993. Next slide, please. Could I have the next slide, please? We started in 1993. I know not all of you are working in rural forested communities, so just as quick context, our county, Trinity County, in rural northwestern California, about 1.25 million acres, about 80% of the county is owned by the federal government, or the taxpayer, you all and me. That creates a unique suite of challenges for economic development and for sustainability and sustainable jobs in communities. In 1993, 92, the early 90s, there was a massive change in how national forest lands were managed, going from intensive timber harvest and management, which was largely the economic engine for our community, to ecosystem management. Essentially, there was a recognition nationally that timber harvest was out of balance with the other needs of ecosystems, that we were endangering or threatening the well-being of species, wildlife, fisheries, habitat. And so a new plan was created to manage public lands, and we were impacted by that plan. It led to massive reductions in timber harvest levels, which also led to, obviously, a loss of jobs in logging, which was one of the primary employment sectors, and then in sawmilling. We had several sawmills in the county, most of them shut down slightly before or shortly after 1993 with the introduction of the Northwest Forest Plan, led to large-scale unemployment, poverty, and a general deterioration in forest health that then happened over time related to a lack of management and fire suppression and this whole suite of complicated issues related to forest management. But basically, we have since that point been at a level ranging between 12 and 21% unemployment. We basically suffer from chronic poverty in our county. The current unemployment rate is 21% countywide. A high percentage of the jobs are with the county government, small population, under 14,000 people within the county as a whole. Hayfork, the community I live and work primarily in, has an unemployment rate probably nearing 26-27% currently. The median household income is around $23,000 to $24,000, something like 60% of the California average median household income. So, like I said, pretty chronic poverty. as you said, the mission of the Watershed Center is essentially to promote healthy forests and healthy communities through research, education, training, economic development, sort of reinvent our community around a new paradigm for managing the forest and a new economic foundation for jobs and for businesses. We've basically been doing green jobs before anyone called them green jobs. For 15 years now, we've been trying to create green jobs around forest restoration and ecosystem management, and in adding value to low-value wood, the wood that comes out of forests thinning and forests, you know, small-scale logging that basically is for the health of the forest rather than focused on the extraction. It's focused on the outcomes on the landscape. I can't think of any greener jobs than those that are about being stewards of the natural environment, and that's what we do. So, moving on, I'll just talk to you about the history of our economic development and job creation programs, focusing primarily on the challenges that we're confronting here in our particular rural setting. And I'll try to, throughout the presentation, tie back into broader rural community challenges, not just related to, you know, the forest and natural resource fields that are what I'm primarily focused on. So hopefully there'll be parallels for each of you in your local contexts. To some extent, there are a lot of threads about rural challenges that regardless of what kind of rural you are unifying. I'll talk about strategies that we've employed over the years to overcome some of those challenges, and the different tactics we've used and partnerships we've built. And then I'll talk about summarizing and talking about outcomes and lessons from the different initiatives we've sort of embarked upon. So the critical challenges here in rural Northwest California in our forest-based public lands community, land tenure and access to resources. Basically, we're rural, we're isolated, and so in a lot of instances, the natural resources are the base of the economy for rural communities, be it agricultural or forestry. Generally, it's one of the, or mining or fisheries. It's generally one of those areas that's tied very directly to natural resources. In our instance, since we don't own the land, we don't really get to decide what happens on the landscape. And so that strongly limits our access to that resource as a source of livelihood. So there's a whole suite of challenges related to that we've had to try to overcome. And I'll talk to you about what those are. We're geographically isolated. We're not next to a major transportation corridor. We have windy, relatively low-quality roads that allow us access to markets. So if we want to do manufacturing here, we have very long distances to ship our product. We don't have rail lines. We don't have access to the interstate. Like I said, we can't use long kingpin-to-axle trailers, so we have to use smaller trailers to ship cargo. Fuel is expensive here. Those are sort of a whole suite of challenges with geographic isolation that, you know, both agricultural, mining, fisheries communities all struggle with. We have a workforce that we basically have to retrain. The capacity of that workforce over time has faded more and more with the lack of jobs over time. And so the skills of that workforce, primarily high school educated and non-high school graduates, are the primary labor and workforce, very few college graduates, and not a lot of real-world skills in the workforce because they've been or are intermittently unemployed throughout their lifetimes. So workforce capacity and training are big challenges. Challenges with contractors' capacity, small contractors and their relative ability to access loans to build up their own capacity to engage in work opportunities. Contractors' ability to learn about contracting opportunities and do contracts with the state and federal governments. There's a lot of registration, certifications, computer savvy that's required in that. And so the relative ability of our contractors to engage in that kind of work both legally, lawfully, and in an efficient manner is very challenging. And then finally, there's this thread of the challenge of infrastructure, and that's hard infrastructure, basically. Do we have access to the kind of power we need to put in a manufacturing facility? Do we have industrially zoned sites that are suitable for new businesses? It's amazing how big an impediment not having access to three-phase power can be if you're trying to put in a manufacturing facility, even a small one. And so interconnection to the power grid, if you're trying to do renewable energy development, can you tie your renewable power capacity into the grid? These kinds of infrastructure challenges. Do you have old industrial buildings that you can do redevelopment in, or have those been torn down and do you need to start from scratch? These are some of the challenges we deal with. So as I mentioned, you know, our approach or our kind of vision for what could be a sustainable economic system that we could reinvent here in our rural community is focused all around ecosystem management. So the actual work in the woods and on the forest and in the streams, doing restoration and doing stewardship, and then the utilization of the byproducts of that work. So basically what comes off the landscape for us as a natural resource is wood, primarily small wood, smaller than was historically used by sawmills. And so what do we do with that small wood, or that biomass, as it's now more commonly called? And how can those be the foundations of our economy here? So our ability to do that all focuses around our ability to build capacity, and that's kind of a catch-all phrase, but it really is what new business development and what job creation and job placement is all about. I'd say here a consistent program of work must coincide with any capacity building effort. In our instance, that means, does the Forest Service offer enough projects consistently over time to build a business around, or is it all fits and starts? Is it one project this year, you try to buy a new piece of equipment, and then next year there's no project, and so you can't make your payments? That, you know, across the country in rural communities, that challenge is the same. Can you find a business opportunity or a work opportunity that has some amount of consistency to it? Is it part of a federal program that's going to sunset in 2 years, and so it's not going to be consistent? Are you going to have consistent access to the marketplace over time, or is that going to erode as well as a offshore producer or a urban area, you know, notices that you've entered into a niche and can do it more efficiently because of all of their competitive advantages, and so moves into it? That's something we've struggled with often. We've had several different initiatives where, particularly starting in 1993, we had a workforce retraining program that was sponsored by the federal government called Jobs in the Woods, and it was providing assistance to retrain displaced forest and mill workers. We worked with the universities around here, Humboldt State University and Shasta College, to create an accredited program for ecosystem management training. We brought people out in the woods and we trained them to do these jobs, stream monitoring and surveys, endangered species monitoring and surveys, habitat restoration in fisheries, streams, terrestrial habitat restoration. So we did this great training program. They own college credits. Contractors started a couple of small businesses around providing these technical services for ecosystem management. And then the funding dried up 3 years later to actually do the real work on the forests. And essentially what we ran into there was a lot of pretty disenfranchised workforce, you know, workers, and some pretty disenfranchised contractors that, you know, basically thought they were being trained to do something that was a real opportunity, and found out that the support for that opportunity wasn't real. This is a very common challenge with both state and federal assistance programs. The focus of those programs changes over time, and so a 2-year or a 3-year program if it's not tied to a much longer-term initiative by the federal or state government, oftentimes erodes from right underneath those people that they've been trying to help and those communities they've been trying to help. That can be a huge setback in rural development, wherein you, as a nonprofit organization, or as a state, or as a county government, or city government, or as an economic development district, try to produce a program to do training, to do technical assistance, to build capacity, invest a lot in it, and the people that engage in your programs invest a lot. They invest their time and energy and their trust and into the idea and their hopes into the idea that there'll be work on the back end of that. And if you haven't thought through that program of work and whether you're training them for a real opportunity in the future or not, or if you're not honest with them about the relative potential for that opportunity, you can really leave people disenfranchised on the back end of that. And it's harder to get them back the second time and the third time and the fourth time. So false hope is something to avoid, and so that's why I talk here about building that consistent program of work in advance. It's not just about training or technical assistance in those ways. Thinking about economic development in rural places has to be a very comprehensive approach where you think about the real work opportunities, the real marketplace, the real contracting opportunities in the long term, and then build a training and workforce and contractor assistance program around those real opportunities. And honestly, if the program of work isn't out there, if you don't know what that's going to be over time, you haven't built the partnerships with the different federal state agencies, nonprofits, economic development assistance corporations, if that and potentially outside business partners, if that's not in place, it's not time to start a workforce training program. The timing of and staging of those things is really critical to success. And disenfranchisement in rural places is a real serious problem and creates or contributes to institutionalized welfare, I believe, and institutionalized poverty and a lack of motivation and a cultural problem with people actually wanting to work and believing that there's opportunities for them that could be sustained in the long term and provide living wage jobs in the long term. What I say here, contractors and workforce will adapt and adopt given consistent work opportunities. It goes right back to that challenge of thinking about cultivating the real opportunities and having a solid foundation for real opportunities prior to or parallel to that training and capacity building among contractors, businesses, and the workforce. They have to align. The fact is that, you know, this picture here is of a mechanical timber harvesting machine. You know, the fact is that the technology to get work done in manufacturing, in natural resource management, you know, be it harvesting or whatever else, that's not the part we have to reinvent as economic development districts or as, you know, technical service providers to you know, needy families, workers, folks on welfare, or burgeoning entrepreneurs or business people. They'll find the right technology and they'll find the capital if the work opportunity exists. This next statement, you know, business development is extremely complex, so work in partnership, that goes right back to the need to have solid partnerships with whoever it is that is the entities that either control the landscape where you work. So if it's a natural resource base, you've got to work with the Forest Service or the Bureau of Land Management or Natural Resource Conservation Service or whoever those agencies are that control the resource. Then you have to work with, ideally you work with the universities and see what programs they offer in terms of assistance to businesses or coupling your initiatives with their own technical assistance or research initiatives. That helps to build the basically it helps to build the exposure and the profile of your initiatives, and that can be really important in terms of garnering additional resources, be they government resources or foundation resources, to help you with what you're doing. And you're going to have to work with the private sector ultimately as well, and I don't mean the private sector you're trying to develop in your community, but the private sector more regionally, or functionally, the private sector that your rural community would have to interact with as part of a market infrastructure that could help you grow new businesses and help you grow jobs. So the work has to go generally outside of your community, your rural community, to all of the potential nonprofit, for-profit, and governmental agencies and organizations that have any potential to create new synergy around whatever your initiative is. I'll talk a little bit more about some of the ones we've worked with here. And in the end, you know, workforce training is going to be essential. You start a new business, you're bringing in, you know, new equipment, new manufacturing processes, new technical jobs in the environment. Ultimately, training is going to be fundamental to all of that, and so the partnerships you build in trying to even create the foundation, the job opportunities, hopefully will lead into the training infrastructure as well. Some of the things we've learned here, particularly around the wood product side, and I think these run true throughout rural natural resource-based and manufacturing, is that value-added, when you're thinking about business development in rural places, think about value-added production. And by value-added, I mean don't just be a primary processor of a raw natural resource. Always think about what is the opportunity to add one level of value to that product, to add two levels, to three levels. How do you reprocess and remanufacture your raw materials into the highest value products, those ones that are ready for the retail market? And so, for instance, whereas in the past a rural community like mine would just have a sawmill that just sold lumber, instead we want to go another step and remanufacture that into flooring. So dry it in a dry kiln, plane it, tongue and groove cut it so that it actually is flooring. In terms of job creation, you go from timber or logs are generally measured in million board feet. 1 million board feet of logs run through a sawmill equals 5 jobs. That same 1 million board feet of timber made into flooring, like you see in this picture here, can equal something like 20 jobs. That same wood then made into something like this cabinet you see here can equal something like 40 to 50 jobs for the same amount of raw material put in. So if you're thinking about job creation in rural places, thinking about the value-added processing, the secondary and tertiary manufacturing, those things that add the absolute greatest value are essential. And then the other thing we've done around this is local branding, so figuring out how to differentiate yourself in the marketplace. And when you come from a rural community, you know, you have certain amenities that are sexy to people in cities that could buy your products. And so figuring out how to brand was really important. One of the really innovative things we did early on with the Watershed Center, when we recognized that we needed to do value-added processing, so not just bring a sawmill back to Hayfork, but actually bring a furniture manufacturer to Hayfork, is we created a rural business incubator. There are business incubators in a lot of cities, but the idea of a rural business incubator was kind of novel at the time, and there have been a few since, and we were one of the first in the U.S. And what the business incubator does is basically creates a low-cost location for businesses to locate, so below market value rental on facilities, access to equipment, technical assistance on business planning, access to loans and capital. So basically provides both a site for businesses to operate in where they can operate at below market value rental and equipment lease rates so that they can get started, and provides them with the technical assistance. So we have a staff for the business incubator that basically provides the technical assistance to help them access work opportunities, build market infrastructure, access loans for capital, access training for their workforce, and allow them to establish themselves as a business in an environment that is more conducive to success, so that they just don't have to go out into the marketplace and compete from the get-out. It helped us to start Jefferson State Forest Products, a business that does tertiary wood manufacturing here in Hayfork. We worked with the county, the Trinity County, to get a piece of land at very low cost. They basically donated the land for this business incubator, and we got a community development block grant to actually build the building, get power run into that building, and purchase a couple of pieces of sort of fundamental equipment, manufacturing equipment, in that building. And then we, the Watershed Center, furthered that whole mission by working in partnership with the fledgling Jefferson State Forest Products to help them basically get, we used grant money. So because we're a nonprofit, we were able to write grants to the federal government and to foundations, private foundations, to purchase even more equipment to help in their manufacturing, and then to lease those to them at a reduced rate over time. So it was good for our business plan because we had a small source of income associated with that, but for them it helped them basically, like I said, operate at below market value costs to get their business going. Over 10 years that business grew in, that's one of the few new businesses started in Trinity County. They produce a lot of organic produce fixtures for like Whole Foods markets, Wild Oats, a lot of the natural food stores around the country, and green furniture, or basically green branded furniture using certified timber and selling into urban markets as socially and environmentally responsible sourced wood products. And they're now up around 40 employees. Grown to 40 employees from zero in about 10 years, and now the third largest employer in our county, and a huge boon to Hayfork and to the community of Hayfork. That was all started with our rural business incubator and a very small amount of capital, personal capital, from the proprietor of that business, the person who started it. Over time, to grow that business, we were not able to take it to the next level, and so this is where outside partnership came into play again, where we went outside of our community to look for additional business partners, and were able to find a socially responsible investment company out of Portland, Oregon. And I don't know how many of you are familiar. Socially responsible investment is this new movement. It was primarily started around, you know, the typical stock market investment strategies, and basically socially responsible just meant their portfolio doesn't include drug, tobacco, or firearms. That's grown to mean something more than that now, and this particular company was set up around the idea that they would invest in small companies around the Pacific Northwest that were trying to be stewards of the environment and recreate a local manufacturing sector in the Pacific Northwest that contributes to the well-being of rural communities. These kinds of companies are popping up, and these investment groups are popping up all over the country now, and your particular rural initiative could find alignment with a company like this, and so it's a matter of networking and putting yourself out there and finding the right company. Upstream 21, the name of the company we found, purchased Jefferson State Forest Products and is now it's now a wholly owned subsidiary of Upstream 21, and they've made significant investments, purchasing new property, buying new equipment, increasing the pay wages for the workers, creating a benefits package for those workers. So it's been a big boon to our community. But the Watershed Center has continued to play a role, whereas we're still able to, through the business incubator, think about innovation and other opportunities for value-added products to help that private sector business continue to grow over time. So there continues to be a role for the nonprofit. The other unique thing we're doing here is working on renewable energy. My talk is about green jobs. As I said, you know, working in the environment, being stewards of the environment is the ultimate green job. Renewable energy is our new green, you know, economy. And so being rural and isolated, of course you would want to create local renewable energy sources. In our instance, wood biomass is the real opportunity. In some of yours, it's probably agricultural waste products, potentially wind or solar. You know, there's the full suite. But in our instance, we have wood. And so we're working on putting in local installations for thermal energy. So working with the school districts and working with the county buildings and the county of Trinity to basically put in very efficient and clean wood boilers that basically use the byproducts of our sawmilling and our tertiary wood processing to heat the facilities here in the county during the winter. Can be a very, it's a great savings over heating oil. If you have natural gas, the savings might not be as significant. But here, we're talking about using our local resource to provide local energy and save our county and our school districts a lot of money. In the process, it creates more value for the wood product, which creates more opportunity for jobs in the woods, and then also creates a well-trained workforce, highly skilled workforce operating those facilities and facilities maintenance. There are several other opportunities around wood energy that we're exploring. Wood cogeneration, densification is like wood pellets, and then liquid fuels. You'll hear about cellulosic ethanol and biodiesel, and all of those are potential products from wood that could help our economy further. So those are some of the other things we're working on. So just to wrap up, really, partnership was absolutely critical throughout the many initiatives that we've had and the fits and starts we've had over the years. We've met with different success around all of those, but we found that having all of this suite of partners engaged on those different initiatives has been key. And I've talked about how the Forest Service, NRCS, the Bureau of Land Management, those organizations and federal entities, we work with them through agreements, legally binding, participating and cooperating agreements that sort of agree that we as entities, a nonprofit and the federal government, are going to work together around job training and rural community development. The Department of Agriculture enters into agreements with nonprofits all the time, so some of your organizations may well have similar opportunities. Having a formal agreement is a great first step towards partnership and attracting new resources and funding over time. Universities, as I mentioned, have been critical in helping us design curriculums for training, delivering training and technical assistance, and then in attracting additional resources in terms of funding for economic development over time. The state of California and the Economic Development District provides assistance to contractors. A lot of times, economic development districts have certain strategies they use to reach people that don't always reach the right audiences, the unemployed in rural communities, for instance, and people on welfare in rural communities. And so the role of the nonprofit remains to work with economic development districts to find other ways to do outreach and to find other ways to do delivery of technical assistance and training that might be novel or different or culturally unique to your rural community. Similar with the Smart Business, the Business Resource Center, they have all kinds of programs. We try to work with them to help bolster the effectiveness of their programs. Some of the foundations you can see that we work with over time, all of these foundations for James Irvine and these ones at the bottom are unique to forestry and environment and natural resources. They all help us to do job creation and economic development. And in almost every sector, there are some suite of private foundations that want to help do economic development and be a partner in that. And these are some of the ones we've found, but they've been essential partners over time that we've been able to continue to go back to make sure that our program doesn't erode like some of those federal programs that only last 2 years, but that we're able to continue to be there for now 15 years and providing that assistance. a novel thing that's emerging, the social enterprise, the idea of a hybrid nonprofit and for-profit business that provides social benefits to communities and to individuals. I would recommend you all check out the Social Enterprise Alliance. It's a network of individuals and organizations that are practicing in this new field and that share lessons and ideas and technical assistance among each other. And finally, you have to have those connections with local businesses, contractors, and workers, and keep those connections up over time so that you can stay engaged and continue to keep pulse with what their needs are so that your programs can be effective in delivering. And with that, I thank you and appreciate the opportunity to talk with you all today.
Thank you so much, Nick. Okay, we're going to move along right along to our next speakers. Our next speakers are Elizabeth Ehrlich, who may be joined by Leila Farcone from the New York City Parks Opportunity Program, and Denise Tolbert and Sabine Martley from the New York City Human Resources Administration. Elizabeth is the Director of Operations and Client Services, and Leila is the Special Projects Coordinator for the Parks Opportunity Program. The program is one of the nation's largest transitional employment programs, with approximately 3,000 trainees working in New York City's parks, playgrounds, and recreation centers. In preparation for private sector careers, Parks Opportunity Program participants gain transferable skills in fields such as security, horticulture, administration, maintenance, and customer service while receiving employment services and career counseling. The program involves 6 months of training and has placed over 9,000 trainees into full-time positions since its inception in 1994. Denise is the Executive Director of Employment Contractor Services, and Sabine is a Senior Project Analyst for the Human Resources Administration, Family and Dependents Administration. They are responsible for creating the training, work experience, and transitional employment programs for those mandated to engage in work activities while receiving public assistance. The New York City Human Resources Administration provides temporary help to individuals and families with social service and economic needs to assist them in reaching self-sufficiency. The administration serves more than 3 million New Yorkers through a diversity of programs and services. And just so that you all know, Elizabeth may have to leave us after her presentation, so if at the time that we have the question and answers, if you have questions for her, still send them, and we will make certain that those questions are answered at a later date. So without further ado, you will now hear from our speakers from New York City.
Welcome all. Thank you for having us.
Hi.
And that's Liza.
Hi, everyone.
I'd like to start by saying, as Nick said, it's a wonderful opportunity to speak to a large and worthy group of people that are all after the same endeavor. New York City and Department of Parks started our program. We're in our ninth year currently, and we're one of the nation's largest transitional employment programs. May we have the first screen, please?
Slide two, please.
Thank you. We're one of the nation's largest transitional employment programs in which participants work in New York City's parks, playgrounds, and recreational centers. As our speaker introduced us, we send approximately 3,000 individuals to this wonderful program.
Thank you, Denise. So POP employees learn transferable skills in a variety of different fields. They're learning hard and soft skills, hard skills in positions that involve maintenance, security, horticulture, clerical assignments, and customer service while they're receiving employment services and career counseling. And some of the soft skills the trainees are receiving while they're with us are negotiating their childcare, showing up for work on time, really learning to get along with their coworkers, and they're working in parks or playgrounds or recreation centers, or in security positions or in offices, and they're learning to really adhere to the fundamentals of work. And, they're gaining experience that helps them transition into employment. They can put it on their resume and really be able to address the work that they're doing in an interview setting. So it makes them more marketable for employment as well. Next slide, please.
We started our partnership in March 2001, and we began to, upon this endeavor, by sending a large amount of TANF participants to the program. In our early stages, we ran into a little glitch during September 11th, and we took a little hiatus, and then marched full force into the program in March 2003. In March 2003, we decided that we would use the participants' actual funding grant, of which we receive and give them for temporary assistance. We then divert a part of that grant in order to fund the participants' salary for this six-month seasonal program. At that point, we use the rest of our funds for that salary from city tax levy. And it's that successful partnership that's allowed us to do at least $6,000 yearly. In our early stages, they were earning approximately $7.50 for a 40-hour work week. We budget the cases. We, at that point, explain to the participants, who are all voluntary participants into this program, and understand that they are required to make their cases remain open so that we can divert the grant towards the salary. They receive job search and employment counseling and training through the POP program.
Are you done, Denise?
Yes.
Okay, I'll pick up here. I also want to say that what's definitely very unique about POP is that we are providing the on-the-job experience, but we're also providing the job search, the employment counseling, and the training and education. That's something that is definitely unique within the landscape of New York City and with these programs in general. And since they are employees of ours, in 2005, a labor union, Union DC 37, won representation of their title, which definitely brought a new dynamic to our program. Once our trainees acquired union representation, through collective bargaining, their salaries increased. They earned days off, one paid personal day and one excused absence. Next slide, please. And, they definitely were able to enjoy a consistent salary increase throughout the next few years, which culminated in $9.21 an hour a few months ago. And as you can imagine, the high salary definitely poses additional obstacles to moving trainees into employment, which we can address a little later on. We began implementing smaller pilot programs in 2006. Our first one was called Youth Engagement Services, and in response to HRA wanting us to service a younger population in a more dedicated fashion, we started a series of one-year pilot programs to tailor services to different segments of New York City's unemployed population, which I will also talk about a little later on. And then most recently, in January of 2009, we placed our 10,000th participant into employment, which is something we are very proud of. Next slide, please.
Who are our trainees? Our trainees are a combination, as you can see from our screen, of various ages with a high concentration for young adults, which is why the YES program. We have a large average age of 27, and we have a race mix-up, which is explained in our chart. We basically have a large TANF population, which has a larger gender of females, and there is a great deal of child care and supportive services that have to be engaged in order to allow this population to successfully work from the hours, I believe, 7 to approximately 6 in the evening. with various schedules making up the 40-hour work week. We usually have to adjust child care to now parents to be able to get to those early hours and remain on the late hours or weekend hours if necessary, which is determined by the Parks program. Our Parks program also, if we can see that we do not have, we have a larger population that does not exactly have a high school diploma, so a great deal of education and training has evolved through the evolution of this program. We have several programs that offer now, through the POP program, more than one day of education and training. We also, as we will explain later on, have several training programs that try to gear our skills that we are looking to find unsubsidized and through training vouchers, which we'll explain further later on. May we have the next slide, please? Liza?
Oh, at the job center and the referral? Do you want to?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. At the start of the program, we at the job center determine who's available to participate in this program. We can only have people participate that are in the head of the case household so that we may divert the family grant. Those individuals are called into the job center upon the initial referral of a couple of letters, and we then have a discussion at those job centers to offer the opportunity of the POP program. We screen out individuals who are not eligible to work due to possible health barriers or medical conditions that we're unaware of, such as asthma, in the green environment of Parks. So once those individuals are screened out, we call them in to a individual data processing appointment that Parks coordinates with us. And generally, as our seasonal concerns are raised during the spring and summer, there is a large amount of people that are called in. We send an individual to those referrals from the job center, and in case between the point of interview and the actual data processing day, there's a new issue that has come up. Possible someone may have broken an arm or had some other condition that wasn't known to them at the point of interview. We remove those people from the data processing via action codes. We have a large computer system that sort of helps us to send these large amount of people to the processing. At that point, we describe for them what the grant diversion process will entail. We cannot send people who were already subsidizing them through special housing grants, such as, I try not to use too many acronyms, but we have certain housing grants where we have to pay the stipend, the rent, above and beyond the TANF eligibility. And that could be due to a medical condition or of another family member. So those cases are, again, weeded out of this. And once we do all of those screenings, there is a large volume of city hiring paperwork, of which we go through people's past criminal backgrounds to make sure that we are not sending any individuals who may not warrant or may not warrant to be around children, possibly in Parks, or any other outstanding warrants that make them ineligible for a city hire at that point. We also have the Parks. They actually conduct a little orientation about how to be appropriate in the workplace. They go over the basic employee orientations that give them the right to know training, equal opportunity policies. They tell them about uniforms and basic timekeeping that will be conducted throughout their six-month tenure at the POCS program. They also, if warranted, we will find out from the Parks whether we need to adjust the child care, whether there will be any nights or weekends, whether there are any other supportive services that we can provide, like offering a budget letter explaining that the employment is temporary and that if they are in federal subsidized housing, that there is no change to those housing rental rates because the job is temporary. Through this program, we also keep the cases open on public assistance so that the person has full Medicaid benefits throughout the duration of the program for 6 months.
It's at this point where we, as we're charged with really preparing a workforce to be deployed to the park or the recreation center that they may be working in. And so, as Denise mentioned, we're giving them a full orientation. We're discussing workplace conduct, right to know in terms of the chemicals they may be using, and the inspection program procedures of our specific agency. We're also making sure that, they're really ready to go work for their supervisors because it's a workforce for us in addition to individuals who are gathering work experience in our program, and we need to make sure that in the beginning we're really giving them the information and the knowledge that they need to be successful when they're deployed to their work site. Next slide, please. As we just discussed, the trainees in our program contribute invaluably to the maintenance of our parks and recreation centers and really to the quality of life in New York City, because we have the parks in New York City are something like 14% of the landmass of the entire city. So we as an agency are charged with maintaining a very large amount of land. And as a result, our JTPs, which is, their title, are cleaning and landscaping parks, maintaining restrooms, comfort stations, repairing and restoring facilities, they're staffing recreation centers, they're providing security, they're working in clerical assignments, and, they're really in all corners of our city, whether it's working in a playground or cleaning, a green street, which is like a median in, a large road, and they're really serving as the face of our agency while gaining job experience. Next slide, please. Not all trainees in our program are performing maintenance and operations assignments because we're not just grass and trees. Here at the Parks Department, we have people on either specific specialized crews or performing assignments, like, as I said, clerical in any of our administrative headquarters or offices, custodial, cleaning the insides of our recreation centers and facilities, fix it, so they're repairing playgrounds and things like that. And we're also offering driver training classes within our agency because there's a large amount of land space that we have to span as staff to take care of, and we do that through vehicles. Next slide, please.
Through POP's partnership with HRA, we have conducted an array of support services that we feel are critical to the tenure of the individual within the POP program. Medicaid is a very, very expensive throughout our country right now, but particularly in large cities where entry-level jobs basically do not come with health care right away. So for the large TANF population, and we do send single adults as well, we maintain the cases openly, and they are eligible through the duration of the program for continued health care. And we'll talk about further on some of the health care benefits that are eligible for the individuals who also are lucky enough to get unsubsidized placement within the POP program. All TANF individuals will get 6 months additionally for additional unsubsidized placement of continued food stamps and Medicaid benefits. We help with housing assistance, again, as I mentioned, with the federal program of our federal NYCHA program and our Section 8 program. We provide resources which alert those benefits, as they should not change the rent that they're currently paying because this job is temporary. We also did a partnership with an additional city agency which serves our homeless population. For individuals who are homeless and in a shelter, once they've been in there for 3 months, we try to encourage them who are eligible to partake in this program as a entry-level job and traditional job for them to be eligible to be paid for under the Work Advantage Program. The Work Advantage Program is a special program where for the first year, the participants are only eligible to pay $50 rent, and therefore the rest of the 921 salary, we encourage them to save, and at which point the Department of Homeless Services will match that benefit for them. Whatever they save in that funding will be matched by the agency up to a certain amount. I believe the amount is $3,000, and we will then encourage them that way to save, and that rent is then increased every year that they maintain a job, and we use this as a transitional start for the first 6 months. And the POP program works very closely with getting those individuals unsubsidized employment because they have this great rent agreement under the Work Advantage program. Again, we also pay child care for the full 6 months that they are in this program, and we'll continue for transitional child care for anyone who gets an unsubsidized placement as long as the children remain under the age of 13. We, for all the individuals that are, again, lucky enough to get unsubsidized employment, we then pay transportation for those individuals for 6 months as another support service. Public assistance also rebudgets all of the cases directly for individuals who are in the six-month program, and if they're not successful in reaching unsubsidized employment, we hope that the skills they use we put them in another program that we have that help them to get further success with job placement and job skills. We hope that this partnership with POP is an excellent resource for them to use on their resume as a first work experience opportunity for a lot of individuals who have been on public assistance for a long time or a mother transitioning back into the workforce. We also, as we try to develop skill training, have a special program of which we use individual training accounts and work with parks to develop skills and have a list of programs that are eligible to provide additional training skills for them, such as security, I think nursing, home health aid, or some of the ones that we use more successfully. We allow them to, as long as the school is state certified by our state of New York, we allow them to partake in that as long as the course is within the 2-day range and that course is then available for them up to 25 accounts are then applied for through the POP program, and as long as the participant is successfully going to the POP program, meaning that they're current, they're not late, they are fully meeting all of the 40 hours a week that they're supposed to, we approve them for that voucher. The vouchers are part-time for 3 months under this program. Next screen, please.
Before I speak about employment skills counseling, I just want to say, in conjunction with the presenter prior to our presentation, we will definitely talk about how partnerships are really a crucial component of the success of our program and the success of HRA and the success of our trainees. If it wasn't for the partnership that Parks and HRA share, we wouldn't be able to extend the opportunities that we extend to our trainees, and we also wouldn't be able to build new partnerships. So that's definitely so far a common theme between these presentations, and I just want to take a moment to point it out. So as we've mentioned extensively, we're not just trying to assist participants in gaining on-the-job experience while they're here. We also are trying to move them into private sector employment at the throughout their line or at the completion. And so we have employment skills counselors on staff, and our trainees are meeting with them once a week or once every 2 weeks, depending on the timing of that they know the time frame that they're in within their line, and they're meeting with them to figure out their career path moving forward, what their skills are thus far, and how they're going to make themselves marketable for employment in a field either that they are looking to re-enter employment in or a field that they're looking to move into for the first time. And so this is where this is really the starting off point, where they are determining their employment plan and how they're going to move forward throughout their time at Parks and how they're going to make the most of the opportunities provided to them through education and training, as we'll discuss in a moment. Next slide, please. Denise, do you want to talk about vocational training and then I'll do the others, or do you want?
Okay. The vocational training is basically one of the options that we identify through the individual training account. The individual training account not only uses basic college courses or basically high occupational demand skills that such as CDL or other demands that are currently viable within our city of New York for placement once the person obtains a certificate. An individual makes an application through the POP program counselor. The application is reviewed, and we evaluate it based on our labor market data to find out whether that request has a viable job placement within our city at this time. Our city agency maintains a database of placements that we currently view monthly in terms of where our participants with skills, with similar skills, and educational values are placed at throughout the city. And based on those, we maintain the viable courses that we have listed in our individual training account. One thing that POP has done that's been a great success is that through their endeavors, they've actually gone through the forefront and developed through some of our college courses with some of our city school systems some additional courses such as the New York Botanical Gardens horticulture course, and I believe Liza is going to talk a little bit more in depth of some of those, but they have actually been able to utilize the individual training accounts to develop some of those specific skills that were basically needed for parks and botanical gardens and other greenery environmental jobs that are at the forefront of what we see now coming in our city and throughout the country. So once the person has been approved for that course, the agency will monitor the person's attendance at that course and look to gain a certificate so that the person does not necessarily get a job right away, but actually has a life skill that would make them transferable throughout the city and possibly throughout the country. So one of the ideal outcomes that we look for from the individual training accounts is that the person actually obtains a certificate, a commercial driver's license, a certified nursing assistant, home health aide, to name a few, direct care worker, so that the person is not just gaining a educational value, but actual has a transferable job skill that can be utilized for their lifetime. Next one. I'm sorry, Liza, did you
do you want me to pick up now?
Yeah.
Okay. So as Denise mentioned earlier when she was going through the demographics of our trainees, we have about 50% that do not have a high school diploma. And so while in the beginning we did not offer education classes, we quickly realized that we definitely needed to, because a high school diploma really will make the difference between someone not being able to earn over minimum wage, which for us is $7.15, or being able to do that. So we partnered with our initial partnership for this was with the New York City's Department of Education Office of Adult Education, who, as we're the Parks Department, Department, we have access to recreation centers, and as the Education Department, they had access to teachers, but, you know, we had the space and they had the staff. So it was a great partnership. We had their teachers start working out of our recreation centers to make classes for our trainees. And so we were able to offer GED classes, pre-GED classes, adult basic education classes, and ESL classes. And then as our program grew, we were able to obtain funding for instructors, and so now we have some of our own instructors on staff holding classes, and then we also have our partnership with the Department of Education where they're providing classes for our trainees. Over time, we realized that it's not enough to prepare someone for the GED, then they just kind of go on a waiting list to take the test. We really need to be able to figure out how to give the test ourselves, and so we partnered with the Adult Education Office for New York State and became an official GED proctor, so we can actually hold the test at our recreation centers now, which give trainees an opportunity to earn their GEDs while they're with us. Additionally, over time, we began to write grants and try to find access to different computer curriculums and programs because really technology became huge, and now I mean any store you walk into that's a chain, if you try to apply for a job, they're not going to hand you an application. They're going to just point to a computer kiosk, and you'll be expected to really be able to apply for jobs online even if the job doesn't require any computer skills at all. So we started really trying to apply for grants to be able to use these programs to teach our trainees how to use computers. And so through IBM, we were able to gain access to two web-based curriculums. And we also incorporated basic computing and online job search and things like that into our curriculum, so that way we can prepare trainees for applying for jobs in the job market. Additionally, the vocational training classes that Denise spoke about earlier, if it wasn't for HRA, we definitely wouldn't be able to make those happen. And it's really provided us with an opportunity to meet with employers and to say to them, okay, you know, what are you looking for? We can give you people. Tell us what skills you're looking for. And then they can tell us the skills. And if we don't have trainees with them, we can approach City University of New York College campus or another training provider and say, we need a training class that will prepare people with these skills because we have the jobs. We just need to be able to train them. And so they'll partner with us to train people for those jobs, which is obviously something that contributes largely to our success. And it's through that ITA voucher process that we can do that. Next slide, please. And so, as Denise mentioned before, they make sure that the certifications that people are getting from these schools are not just like a random certification that the school's giving. It's an industry-recognized certification where the individual can go wherever and find a job because it's not linked to, you know, a specific school or something. So this is just an example of some of the certifications and licenses that we're able to help people obtain. Next slide, please. And again, in terms of our partnerships, they're absolutely crucial to our success, both working with public entities like the City University of New York, which encompasses a lot of the colleges that you see on the screen, to Securitas, which is the largest provider in the country of largest provider in the country of security services, and that is a training provider that we work with where they will train and employ our trainees in private sector employment when they're done. Next slide, please. So you may be wondering how we build relationships with companies, and that definitely is a challenge for us also, and comes down to partnerships. When we refer trainees to jobs with our partners, we have to make sure that they are the best trainees for the job that we can find. It's very important that we pre-screen them in advance and that we're really only referring people who are meeting the specific requirements of that job. Recruitment days is something that we've started doing over the past few years, and it's been very successful. When a company reaches out to us and says, oh, we have multiple, you know, available positions, we'll kind of call together a group of trainees who meet all of the requirements in advance and then sit the employer down with them so they're not wasting their time meeting with a bunch of people who don't qualify for the positions or, you know, aren't enough people. So if they reject one or two or three, maybe there are five more that they'll want to hire. So that's a very successful medium for us as well. With regards to career-specific training, we discussed that in the previous slides, and oftentimes a employer is able to say to us, hey, I'm really looking for people with these skills, and we can say, okay, well, we can get them the skills. We have the people. We'll train them to have the skills. And so we develop these training classes with some of our partners that we indicated earlier, and then we're able to leverage vouchers to pay for them. Market-driven job preparation was part of what Denise spoke of earlier. You know, we're looking at the employment trends also to make sure that we're preparing people for employment that actually exists, not just a training class that someone can take to say, oh, I finished this training class, and that's it. Next slide, please. We're also able to have trainees work with organizations prior to hire. We host networking events where our partners really come together and they're able to kind of celebrate the fact that they play a role in changing the lives of New York City's unemployed. We invite our service providers, and then we invite our employers, and we'll invite new employers that we're trying to bring to the table so they can network with our existing employers and really see the services that we can provide for them. We host semi-annual job fairs, and we also educate employers about their tax credit options if they hire trainees who are receiving public assistance. And we communicate with employers through mailings as well. Next slide, please. And this is just a quick kind of indicator of what some employers say about POP. And, it's definitely part of why I think we're able to be successful is because if they look at us as being kind of an extension of their organization in terms of really knowing what they need to successfully, bring people on board, for us to know what they're looking for in their job candidates, then we're able to really provide them with the people that they're looking for. Next slide, please. And it's really because of some of the things that I've been talking about and what Denise has said as well that, we've able to really leverage our partnerships and work closely and be in constant communication and create these supportive services for trainees and give them positive on-the-job experience and, all of that has really made our program successful over the years. As you can see, within the past 6 years, we've had a 128% increase in the amount of private placements, which is very significant and is definitely in part to us being able to leverage the resources through the partnerships that we've cultivated. Next slide, please. And this is just kind of a sampling of some of the areas where our job placements fell last fiscal year. New York City is definitely a huge, it has a huge cross-section of industries and our placements, it's really reflected in our placements. And this is just kind of an example of that. As you can see, like maintenance and industrial labor, administration, security, customer service, those are things that our trainees are experiencing while they're in their jobs at the Parks Department. And it's work experience that they're getting from that that is definitely helping them move forward into private sector employment. Next slide, please.
Part of what our partnership highlights is that we try to view retention as a very key element of this program. We have that focused in by two basic areas. We provide retention tool demands of the partnership. For our clients, as I mentioned, for specific TANF-based families, we provide those families with 6 months of federal food stamps uninterrupted at the time that their grant started the program. So if the person is earning within the federal guidelines, that food stamp grant will continue for more than 6 months. But if it's within the guidelines that is a little higher than the federal guidelines, we will get federally funded food stamps to what we call transitional food stamps for employment closings. We provide child care in addition to for those same benefits for TANF families as long as the children remain under 13. The Medicaid, again, will continue for 6 months for families who close or for employment from this program as well. In addition, there's a client bonus that we like to pay the participants who are also placed called transportation bonus. We allow the Parks program to provide the individual with transportation costs, which, as you can imagine, is rather high in the city of New York, this is a great bonus for them, for a family who's basically starting off maybe at minimum wage, as Liza said, $7.15 an hour or higher. So those client retention services are very supportive for the individuals. And with the food stamps, they get transitioned to another part of HRA, which again provides those services for food stamps and Medicaid. As part of the contractual partnership, we have a performance-based measure that we have had POP agree to, the Parks Department, at the onset of this partnership. There is a performance-based incentive for a person who's placed in an unsubsidized job, who remains in the job for 90 days. There's a high-wage bonus and a 180-day bonus, as well as if the person's case closes totally off public assistance, there's a case closing bonus. And that's the combination of our retention services we feel is both supportive and provides incentive both for the client and for the POP program, as which we saw in the previous screen, highlighted by those placed in private employment. For anyone placed in a subsidized employment, while we think that's a very good outcome, there is no performance-based incentive for that. We also have a lot of other support services, such as clothing grants, a domestic violence program that we provide counseling and safe housing for any individual in need of that throughout the program, as well as through the private placement portion of the program where the person is off public assistance. Next screen, please. Liza?
Hi, Denise. I'm sorry. This is Sarah. Liza stepped away for 2 minutes. She had an urgent call from the commissioner's office.
Okay. Well, I'll talk a little bit about their new dedicated program.
I apologize. It was just very urgent.
Okay. I can imagine. The part of what we've now, one of the new programs that they've now done is called POP Education Horticulture Program. This is one of the year-long programs, and I believe it started in 2007, and it's for a small group of individuals, 35, who are to do 2 days' worth of education and hopefully gain some college education with that. POP Plus is an extension of the YES program that we spoke about earlier. We had a great deal of difficulty finding individuals who could fit the category of 18 to 21, as well as being the case head. As we can imagine, in the city of New York, we do have a large population, as we saw from our age graphic, but we are unable to find them who were the case head. So we extended the age for 18 to 25, and this is the second successful year of this program. And this program works with the model, again, of it's for 1 year, and it's for 2 days of education and 3 days of work at $9.21 an hour as well. And our commissioner had a great idea, and he wanted to work with individuals who fathers who are in our city and unable to meet the child support payments that they are required to make. So we started a new program with POP, and it's called POP Works, of which there is another branch of HRA, which decides that is part of what they do is they work with dads to help them start to pay their child support. And we wanted to take this to another level. We wanted to reestablish the family bond. Even though the family may not be together, this program is geared towards counseling services where the father is hoped to try to establish a relationship with the child, and as well as try to pay the supportive services for the child's rearing. This, again, is one of the a year-long model, and we think it's been one of the successful endeavors that we have worked together with for POP. So may I have the next slide, please? That concludes our POP presentation today, and I unfortunately have another meeting at 2:30, but I think I could take one or two quick questions.
We're actually going to wait for questions until the end, so we will send you any questions that you get, and we'll make sure that those get answered later on.
Okay, thank you for your participation.
Yes, thank you all so very much. So we're running a little short on time, so I'm going to go ahead and move right on to our next speaker, who will be Ms. Pauli Ohea, and please forgive me if I pronounce your last name incorrectly. She is
That's
from
all right.
Green for All. Green for All is a national organization dedicated to building an inclusive green economy that helps lift people out of poverty. By advocating for local, state, and federal commitment to job creation, job training, and other opportunities in the emerging green economy, especially for people from disadvantaged communities, Green for All fights both poverty and pollution at the same time. Green for All works to link various stakeholders and community leaders together in dialogue to advance the vision of a green economy that benefits all Americans. The organization also focuses on increasing public awareness of potential green job opportunities, leveraging best green practices and policy into model programs and legislation that can be adapted at the national, state, or local level, providing technical assistance to mayors and community groups to implement local green collar job initiatives, and build an online community of practice to convene thought leaders and share leading program models, technical documents, and templates. Ladies and gentlemen, Pauli.
Hello, thank you so much. Can everyone hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. I wasn't sure if the mute was working. My name is Pauli Ohea, and I'm here with Green for All. And I just want to thank you for hosting this really informative webinar. And I'm so happy to be sharing the stage, if you will, with people from the Watershed Program and POPs, which are two amazing programs that I think really highlight the potential for green jobs to provide pathways out of poverty. And I'm going to sort of take a big step back a little bit and talk some about why we're doing this, and then talk some about what kinds of opportunities may be available in rural communities. And I think I can advance. Oh, it looks like I can advance the slides. Jacqueline, are you able to do that? Thank you. So, you know, just to start out, this is an image that many of you have seen, of course, it's during Hurricane Katrina, which is one of our more recent reminders of how climate change is impacting communities across the country. And, you know, one of the reasons that I show this is that we really want to highlight, you know, not just the impact of climate change on the planet, of course, but on people, and especially on low-income communities. This is one type of disaster that we've experienced, and there's many other kinds of public health threats that we imagine will be coming down and have already been as a result of climate change. Next slide, please. I also want to talk a little bit about what's happening in our communities. As we see the unemployment rate continues to go up, there's very high rates of respiratory illnesses, cancers, and other diseases, increases in health problems that are caused by environmental pollution, a scarcity in community capital and wealth accumulation opportunities, incarceration rates, especially among low-income communities and communities of color, and overall disenfranchisement from the political process and lack of engagement in the political process. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Thank you. So Green for All, we sort of came about as an organization just over a year ago, about a year and 3 months ago, to really try to deal with some of those problems by helping to build this green economy, which includes the work that my colleagues have been doing. We saw that we believe that the green economy would be able to fight poverty and pollution at the same time, and believe that a move to a clean energy economy would be able to increase wealth-building opportunities for those in need of economic advance, and would also be able to improve the health and overall well-being, especially in low-income communities who, again, are suffering more from cancer, asthma, and other ailments. Green for All's mission is to help build an inclusive green economy that's strong enough to lift people out of poverty, and some of the ways that we do that, talked about this a little bit, but I'll just go over. We work on public policy at the federal, state, and local level, advocating for policies that will help create demand for green jobs and green collar jobs, as well as training programs and pathways out of poverty. We work locally, helping cities and counties who want to try to create green jobs initiatives, helping them out with technical assistance and helping them attract green business. We work at the personal and the community level, which means that we're working with leaders, community leaders, organizations, people who are implementing programs, such as my colleagues are doing, to really get them connected to one another, get them sharing the experiences that they've had, sharing success stories, and really highlight those stories and give them a lot of attention and use that to leverage more funding for programs like that, more policies passed that will help create programs like that, and really, again, you know, just help build more of a movement and more of a call out in the nation for more of what you've just been hearing about for the past hour or so. We also work with the business sector explicitly to make sure that there's access for people of color and low-income people to take part as workers, as consumers, and as entrepreneurs. Next slide, please. Thanks. So I want to go over briefly some of the ways that we define green jobs here at Green for All, and of course this is something that, you know, people are going to have different ways of explaining this, but these are some of the guidelines and some of the things that we look for as we talk about green jobs. We see green jobs as a way to rebuild a strong middle class. So a lot of times when we're talking about green jobs, we speak in terms of green collar jobs, jobs that are accessible for people who are at sort of a middle skill level, so that don't necessarily require a college degree or an advanced degree, but do require some more skills than perhaps a high school diploma or something like that. There will be a lot of opportunities like that in the green economy. We believe that green jobs need to be building pathways out of poverty, and I think the POP program is a beautiful example of that. We want to make sure that there are ways that people can actually gain access and gain entrance into this economy. You know, just because we create jobs doesn't mean that they are going to have the right people trained up to do them, and that we have a way for someone who hasn't had access to the education or to the training to find a way into this economy. You know, how can we build on ramps for people onto this economy? They tend to be local jobs. You know, we really want to see the production, manufacturing stay here. Installation, of course, will be local if we're talking about installing solar panels and things like that. We don't want to be exporting our green jobs. We want this economy to be different. Green jobs will be strengthening urban and rural communities, and I would add suburban communities to that as well. Clearly protecting the health of the planet and the health of the people. Want to make sure that these jobs not only are good for the environment, but that they're also jobs that are good for the individuals doing them. So, again, really thinking about a different way of moving forward in jobs. We don't want to have people working in jobs that are toxic, for example. That they're accessible to our most needy communities, again, that these jobs are in areas where people need the work and that we're able to connect the people who most need the work with the work that needs to be done. And that we're talking about family-supporting career-track jobs, that they have opportunities for advancement, that they help move people along a career ladder, and that they provide good wages and things like that. Next slide, please. So I'm going to spend most of the time talking about explicitly the kinds of jobs that will be available in the clean energy economy. Of course, the way that we deal with energy in this country is huge, and it makes an enormous impact on our economy and on global warming, and it's certainly one of the ways that we see being able to create large numbers of green-collar jobs and help significantly reduce our carbon footprint. So I am going to be talking today about energy efficiency, about especially building and home retrofits. I'm going to be talking about the potential for renewables, solar and wind, and I'm also going to be talking about alternative fuels. And actually, can we go back a slide? I just wanted, now that we're talking about alternatives, this picture is of a man who is working in what was or currently is a brownfield site in Pittsburgh, where an organization called G-Tech has been working with community members to plant sunflowers and I believe canola and a few other plants that they're going to be using for biomass and biofuel locally. And so they have a few vacant lots that they've employed where people are doing this work. So anyway, moving along, thank you. And we can go to the next slide. So first I'll talk about energy efficiency. And energy efficiency is, it's kind of often referred to as like the low-hanging fruit, right? Like this is where, this is something that can happen now. This is something that doesn't require any new technology, doesn't require, years of waiting for something else to come along, an idea. It doesn't require new science. It's as simple as let's seal up our buildings to make them not leak as much energy. Let's switch out our light bulbs. Let's put insulation in the houses. So this is something that could create thousands and thousands of jobs, and that would really make a very big impact on our environment. The cheapest and the cleanest energy, of course, is that which you're not using. So this is really, really step one as far as tackling global warming and creating millions of jobs. So I just want to go over a few of the facts, and a lot of you on the phone probably know this, but basically we know that 55% of all U.S. energy is wasted, and that efficiency is the fastest and the cheapest way to address global warming. Americans spend more than 5% of their income on energy, and low-income Americans spend more than 16% on energy. And low-income housing in rural communities tends to be even less energy efficient. It is estimated that if you were to put $1 million into retrofits, if you were to invest $1 million into retrofits, it would create about 12 jobs for that amount of money. And so if we were to invest $10 billion a year in retrofits, we could create 120,000 jobs. And of course, retrofitting homes will save occupants money, create jobs, and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And a lot of these jobs are jobs that are very similar to jobs that already exist and require a little bit of training, but aren't anything that requires a great deal of technical skill. They're jobs, electrical jobs, construction jobs, energy auditing, insulating, plumbing. All of these are jobs in energy efficiency. And, of course, I will talk about this a little bit more later, but we have gotten a great deal of funding to do energy efficiency as a result of the recovery package, and I can mention that a little bit more. Next slide, please. So, of course, solar power is another big source of renewable energy, and which has a lot of potential in rural communities, especially in the West. And they're very labor intensive. I just put some numbers there about the estimates of how many people it would take for employment, about 20 manufacturing jobs and 13 installation and maintenance jobs per megawatt of energy. And the installation and the maintenance tend to be local jobs, of course, because they're putting them on in local buildings. And then manufacturing often depends on the demand and the incentives. The solar companies tend to go where the market happens to be. And they do require some more technical skills, so it does require some added training for folks, and that also means that they tend to provide pretty good wages. And there's, at the end, I'll point people towards some resources to learn a little bit more about all the different industries. Next slide, please. When another renewable resource that we talk a lot about, of course, is wind power. It's a zero emissions energy source. It's definitely a rapid growth and a very high profile industry. The U.S. has been leading for the past 3 years in wind power installation, and there's great potential in Midwestern states and rural communities, and job growth here in manufacturing the turbines and the components, in operations, in installation and maintenance, and many, many other related roles in order to create these things and get them up and make sure that they're maintained. Next slide, please. And then biofuels, which, you know, there's just many different kinds of biofuels and biomass that we talk about, and the actual efficiency and the sustainability and the job creation will vary among the different crops and the processes, and so I think that's something important to sort of pay attention, depending on what the natural resources in the area are. Right now, the job creation is not, the numbers aren't as high as they are in some of the other sectors, but with technological advances in biofuel and biopower, there will hopefully be a lot more opportunity. And we've, in a report that Green for All produced along with the Apollo Alliance and CAL, the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, we talk a lot about focusing on the bioeconomy in the sense that if states are really prepared for sort of an integrated approach to biofuels and biomass, in the sense that they are thinking about, you know, the technological production of new fuels and also the creation of other types of products that are made with organic matter, if states are prepared to really to get involved in all of those sectors, they will be better off to really reap the benefits of you know, biomass and biofuel. So this is definitely an area for growth, and again, depending on what type of biofuel you're looking at. You know, there's different levels of sustainability and benefit, and of course job creation as well. Next slide, please. I wanted to talk a little bit about green jobs on tribal lands as well, specifically, and our friends at the Indigenous Environmental Network have been doing a lot of work around this and really ensuring that the concerns and needs of tribal communities are heard in these discussions around green jobs development. Of course, there's a lot of opportunity for renewables on native lands, and you'll see some of the numbers that are estimated here. 535 billion kilowatt hours per year is a potential for wind power generation, and an estimated 12,000 billion kilowatt hours per year of solar electricity potential, which is 4.5 times the U.S. annual generation. And so, again, you know, there's a very big potential. There's a big need because of the high unemployment and poverty, really often inefficient, energy inefficient homes in Native communities, and the importance, of course, will be to ensure that there's local investment, local hiring, local training, and use of local materials and ownership in Native communities. Next slide, please. So I wanted to just point to a few examples around the country that are exciting that have been able to focus on renewables and bring jobs into different areas. Many of you may know of the Spanish company called Gamesa that owns two wind turbine manufacturing plants in rural Pennsylvania. One is in Edinburgh, and the other one is in Fairless Hills, which is at the site of the former U.S. Steel plant. They've employed about 1,160 workers in Pennsylvania, and I do policy work at Green for All, so I'm going to talk a little bit about policy, but I just want to, you know, note, of course, the importance of public policy in making successes like this happen. Pennsylvania passed a measure in 2004 that required 18% of the state's electricity come from renewable sources by 2021. So again, this really provided incentive and opportunity for a company like this to come into Pennsylvania and set up shop. Next slide, please. In Iowa, there are plans for two large community-owned wind farms in the counties of Emmett and Dixon, 300 and 200 megawatt wind farms, again, in northwestern Iowa. Right now, Iowa employs about 1,400 workers in existing wind turbine and component manufacturing facilities. And the projections are that for 500 megawatts, there'll be 800 construction jobs and 125 or more jobs in operations and maintenance. And the company is developing other large community wind projects in Minnesota, Iowa, South Dakota, North Dakota, and Colorado. Next slide, please. And there's also a proposal in West Virginia right now for the Coal River Wind Project, which is proposed to go on a river where on a ridge where mountaintop removal has been sited. The project would create 154 turbines, bring 300 megawatts of power, and employ 200 construction workers initially and 50 employees long term, and they think that more over time as the demand increases. Next slide, please. So, again, you know, what is it going to take to have more successes like this and have create more opportunities in rural communities and everywhere? We need public policy to create the demand and to help develop training and align training that is out there already. We need dedicated funding for renewables development, for energy efficiency, for things like that. So, of course, make sure that that there's investment and that there are places that we're going to funnel people into jobs. Next slide. These are some examples of different policies that fuel green growth. There's state renewable portfolio standards. Many states have these standards either already established or in place. And you can find out if your state does or does not and exactly what those standards are on the website of the Apollo Alliance, and I'll send you a link to that. There's state energy efficiency resource standards. It's all public knowledge. You can find out exactly what kinds of standards exist in your state. Many states have, states and local governments have climate action plans that would incentivize renewables, which would incentivize energy efficiency. There's the federal production tax credit, again, incentivizing energy efficiency and renewables. And most recently, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, a.k.a. the stimulus, which provided a lot of funding for the kinds of programs that we want to see happening, and definitely a lot for green jobs and training. At Green for All, we've been paying special attention to the funds that will create green worker training and also energy efficiency programs. So some of the pieces that we're most excited about are there's $500 million for green jobs training. There is $3.2 billion for energy efficiency and conservation block grants, which help states do weatherization and energy efficiency measures, for the most part, on federal buildings. There's the Weatherization Assistance Program, and that's $5 billion, and that is assistance to low-income homes to do energy efficiency retrofits. There's also $3.1 billion for state energy programs, again, to help increase renewables, energy efficiency. There's an extension of the production tax credit to increase incentives for energy efficiency and renewables, and especially for wind and biomass, and $60 billion in loans for renewables. So there's a lot of good stuff in that package that if we are able to do it well, and if we're really able to show some successes, we can sort of see it as a down payment on all of the other projects that we want to still do. I mean, of course, as we all know, this money is to be used quickly, and for the most part for projects that already are somewhat in the works. But if we are able to really show the successes of something like that, and the success of how many jobs we can actually create through green economic development, it'll benefit us in the future and will help us secure future funding for things like that. The big question mark this year and in the years that will follow will be whether we will be getting more investments in green economic development through a climate and energy bill. And right now, there is a bill, as you all know, that's in the House that would create a cap and invest program, a cap and trade program for the United States. And there is a lot of funding that could be available there for energy efficiency, for the development of renewables. And this is something that, you know, we're all paying very close attention to over the next couple of months. But it would, if passed, it would be something that would provide great opportunity. Next slide, please. So I just wanted to put out there some of the resources that we have available. Green for All has a guide available that helps communities learn about what's in the recovery package when different deadlines are occurring, and what how communities can get themselves to be part of the process for determining where the funds go. You can find that at greenforall.org/recovery. Can you hear me still?
Yes.
Okay, great. I just got really quiet. We also have examples of what folks are doing in the green economy at our resource page, and I'd actually really like to connect with my colleagues who were just on the call to add some of the work that you're doing there. The Apollo Alliance also has some really good information, and I talked about the different policy initiatives that that would be helpful for states and local governments to know about, and you can find that at New Energy for States is one of the reports I was talking about, but if you go to their website, to the reports page, there's a lot of good information there. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance does a lot on energy programs, especially renewables and community-owned power in rural communities. There's the Indigenous Environmental Network that I mentioned, and also a website for Coal River Wind if you're interested in learning more. And all of the reports that I talked about you can find on greenforall.org/resources. And I believe that's it, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much. Mark, I know we're well over time, but can we still entertain questions?
We sure can, sir.
Okay. Thank you. So we'll now open the lines up for questions.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. And if you are using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering your request. One moment, please, for our first question. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, to register for a question, press the 1 followed by the 4. There are currently no questions on the phone line, sir.
We do have one question from live meeting for both speakers. I think the New York speakers had to go, but for the other two, how has the current economic environment impacted your efforts?
Can you hear me?
Sure. Yeah, you can go ahead.
Yeah, this is Nick with the Watershed Center. Regarding our businesses and initiatives here locally, the current economic situation has been particularly tough on wood products and the logging industry, with home starts down.
Sorry, Nick, this is James. We cannot hear you.
Okay. I don't know how to make you hear me. I have everything on my phone is on, mute off, and so I'm not sure if there's something I can press that would make that possible or not.
Go ahead, but your voice is very low. Go ahead.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, better now.
Okay. Locally here, the wood product sector has been really significantly impacted by the current economic conditions, particularly, you know, pretty much everything in forest products tied to housing and housing market down by about 60%. Particularly in California, it's not good. But helping us has been federal injections of funds through the stimulus package for the Forest Service and for job placement and creation and poverty alleviation through economic development districts and job training programs. So we've actually partnered with the local economic development district and the Smart Business Resource Center. So we're basically doing kind of, it's sort of like the Civilian Conservation Corps programs of the past, where basically you're working with the Forest Service and putting people to work temporarily, you know, for 6 month periods, paying minimum wage. And some of the challenges with that is it's obviously short term, only associated with the stimulus, and they don't earn unemployment as part of those programs. And so when they do get laid off in the fall, they're not going to be able to collect unemployment benefits. So there's just going to be, you know, necessity for another assistance program. So it doesn't really get us out of the woods by any means, but it's at least cushioning the blow. But like I said, you know, in Hay Fork, somewhere around 27% unemployment, so we're not doing well.
I would just add, as you know, our work is to really, on a you know big picture level, is to help promote this idea that that we do have this economic crisis on our hands, but that the solution to that economic crisis could be to move towards green, and that the green economy is the only part of the economy that's actually growing. So our, you know, our whole work is to really make the case that this is true, and that we can address the issues that we're dealing with in the economy and provide opportunities in this green economy at the same time. And of course, there's challenges. There's challenges to making that case, and the more that we're able to point to success stories, the more that we're able to show the parts of the green economy that are growing and the jobs that have been created by that, the greater we can make that case.
Thank you. Mark, are there any other questions on the phone?
No, ma'am.
Okay. And I'll turn it back over to James Butler.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie. Well, I just want to thank everyone for joining us again today, and thank you for hanging in there with us for the extra time. Thanks to all of our speakers today. I think all of the presentations were very good. Thank you for sharing your expertise and your experiences with us on your rural economic development initiatives that serve TANF participants. As in the past, PowerPoint presentations and audio recordings from today's webinar will be made available for everyone within the coming weeks. Also, you may feel free to email anyone on the Rural Communities Initiative team if you have any further questions. So on behalf of the Office of Family Assistance, I thank you all very much and continue to have a pleasant day.